Distributing the Future broadcast October 23rd, 2006, Spirituality and Altruism.
The future is going to be bigger than the past. There's going to be more happening. Connected systems, connected devices, connected data. What can we do in that world that will be interesting, powerful, and useful?
Changing the world through capturing the knowledge of innovators.
The future is here. It's just not evenly distributed yet.
Welcome to Distributing the Future from O'Reilly Media. I'm Daniel Steinberg, and each week we bring you the technology and the people behind what you use now and what you'll use next. What is this show on technology doing focusing on spirituality and altruism? Craig Warren Smith will help you see the connections between computing and spirituality, and Tor Nordtrondes will convince you that altruism is to humans what ornate tail feathers are to the peacock. A couple of years ago at MacHack, some folks were playing with a game where the controller was this glowing blue orb. It was different enough that I was drawn to it, and the next thing I knew, my fingers were hooked up to the biofeedback device, and I was trying to stack rocks and shoot arrows at a target by regulating my breath and pulse. It's a different sort of relationship with the computer. Craig Warren Smith thinks we're going to see a whole lot more of that pretty soon. Check out spiritualcomputing.com for a look at where he's headed. He thinks that the Web 2.0 ideals are well suited to websites that build community first and place commerce second. I've edited down his side of our conversation from this year's Foo Camp. His goal is to
bring the world of spirituality and the world of technology together. Technology companies that are serious about gaining network effects are in the experience business, and the experts on experience are people who know spirituality. The conditions have arisen finally for spirituality and technology to meet over the question of what is meaningful experience. If you look at a site like Wikipedia or Craigslist or, maybe a new site like The Second Life, they don't look all that commercial. And you have to struggle hard to find the business model. Because the primary agenda of these sites under the Web 2.0 model is to win loyalty of users. What I'm presenting through spiritual computing is a method that they can use to determine whether they're creating meaningful experiences or not. It's thanks to the Dalai Lama's interaction with the field of neuroscience that these measures can arise, because adept meditators are being studied with new technologies, and there's now new ways of visually or through sound depicting a state of advanced meditation. So it tells us what the empowered brain looks like, what optimal brain health looks like, and you can compare that with where most people are, and then you can see if you can bring users incrementally towards more meaningful relationship to their own minds. Different forms of gaming can, for example, use biofeedback mechanisms and new interfaces to introduce you to your own body experiences, your sensory experiences, and actually change the quality of your experience. As things become less text-based, less or talk-based, there are more opportunities to bring users through a process in which the discovery of spiritual motives arise in a way that they would never expect. And they wouldn't necessarily call it spiritual. You know, when George Lucas sat down with Joseph Campbell and created the concept of the Force and brought that into Star Wars, it created enormous market impact, you know, in the Star Wars saga. But people didn't think of themselves as having become spiritual for the viewing of it, and yet the design of Star Wars was affected by a spiritual input. 30 years later, that spiritual input into design can be even more powerful. The point is not for people to self-identify as spiritual or religious or whatever. The point is to broaden and deepen the experience of people so that they no longer hold tightly to a narrow pattern of cognitive activity, that they become comfortable with exploring the true nature of their own minds in all its breadth and depth, which is the fundamental method of spirituality. Because neuroscience now has given us tools to tell us if someone has been able to sort of crack the code on how their cognitive and their affective brain systems can converge through spiritual practice, that presents some measures. So this allows the commercial forces and governments and so forth to support activities that they might have avoided in the past because they didn't want to get involved in religious crossfires. But in fact, various religions themselves will adopt spiritual computing in order to enhance the spiritual experience of their own members. So this isn't entirely a secular activity. You can easily imagine Islam, the Catholic Church, developing spiritual communities under the social computing model that will redirect the attention of these religions to the nature of the experience that their founders, Muhammad or Christ, embodied. Neuroscience itself could be considered a kind of religion. It has great legitimacy in the realm of science. The key neuroscience labs in the world can create enormous breakthroughs in terms of how spiritual knowledge enters healthcare and educational systems that are essentially supported by governments. China, at a certain point, will wake up to the notion that it owns the jewels. Tibet is a source of spiritual experience that may well be brought into a new kind of ethical framework that may arise in China, Tibetan Buddhism, but also the feng shui and Taoist notions are very rich. For example, feng shui will help system architects create notions like sacred space and how to work with physical spaces that are aligned energetically so that people can experience the concept of sacred space. Or Taoist principles can enter the healthcare system in China. Qigong and Tai Chi and so forth principles, so that online interaction can help support the training in those activities as well as their integration into everyday life. Programming itself, developing, is itself a spiritual act. And ultimately the aim will be to help users become their own programmers using ultimately the new tools. So programming itself at its heart is a very creative and rich experience. And spiritual training can help the programmer balance all the forces that need to be brought into a program and gain the passion it takes to do really great code. Programming is not at war with spirituality. The geek culture, with its libertarianism and its openness to new ideas, can see spirituality as simply a way of furthering creativity within its own profession. We're developing a spiritual computing research group composed of technology labs all over the world that are both academic and corporate. And these labs will bring into interaction the people in the research institutes that are interested in finding the interface between spirituality and technology. And so I'm going to Google and Microsoft and Nokia and Yahoo and so forth to find who are those people, what is their vision of that connection, and then what twist do they have on this theme. And we'll create environments where they can jam with each other and produce the applications. So right now, this sounds a little abstract, right? And what is this? What's this guy talking about? But it's really up to those people to give life to this vision.
Craig Warren Smith works at the Human Interface Technology Laboratory at the University of Washington. You can read more on spiritualcomputing.com. Tor Norotronders was one of the keynoters at this year's EuroOSCON. He, too, has been thinking about the intersection of man and computers. When people compete with computers, he explains, they behave differently than when they know they're competing with an actual human. That's the first leg in his talk called The Glow, The Show, and The Flow, which he links at the end to Web 2.0.
The Glow is about a discovery that was made in the past 25 years in studying how humans behave. Most signs dealing with human beings seem to assume that we are homo economicus, that is, the economical man, that we are selfish and rational beings that only go for our own interests. The whole economy is built on that. And that might be true at one level, but at another level, it is untrue in a very interesting way that was discovered through a number of games and experiments done in experimental economy. And the most beautiful of these is called the Ultimatum Game, and it was founded by Werner Güss and colleagues in Berlin in 1980. In the Ultimatum Game, you have two players. Player one is given 100 euros on the condition that he will share this money with player two in a way that player two will accept. If player two doesn't accept player one's suggestion for how to share this money, then nobody gets anything. So player one can say, okay, I give the other guy half. I'm pretty sure he will say yes, and we both get 50 euros, and everybody's happy. But then he goes back and he reads his textbooks of economics, and he says, well, the other guy is selfish and rational. So if I say, well, I'm the one giving the ultimatum, so I want 90 euros, and I offer him 10 euros. If he's selfish and rational, he should say, well, 10 euros for just saying yes, that's good, I take the 10 euros. If I say no, I get nothing and he gets nothing. So a selfish and rational player should say, I accept even if it's only 10 euros. But what you find when you play this game with people, and you start off with students in business schools in the Western countries, and you get so baffled by the results that you repeat them as people have done in all cultures, in all kinds of societies, on all continents of this planet, and you see the same result everywhere. If player one offers player two less than 20% of the cake, less than 20 euros in this example, player two will say, I don't want your bloody and small piece of stupid, silly money. You will not have anything. I will not have anything. I want to punish you for being unfair. This is not selfish. This is not rational from player two. Player two should say, oh, I'm happy with the 1 euro or 5 euros, but he doesn't say so. Player two insists on fairness. And it seems that somehow human beings care so much for each other that we accept to not get money that is paying for making other people behave in a nice way. And that's surprising. If you put people in the same ultimatum game, and they know that they are playing with a computer rather than a human being. Player one is now a computer. Player one offers the other guy, who is a human being, something like 1 euro out of 100. What will player two say? He will say, thank you. I'm very happy. I take one euro from you. Because you're a computer, you're an idiot anyway. I can't educate you. You're silly and stupid anyway. So when we play with computers, we act as economic men. We act as the homo economicus, being selfish and rational, because it doesn't help educating this thing. So we need human beings, and we have to worry about a future where all our social interactions are mediated by software agents and robots, because then everybody will start treating each other as economic men, and we will not bond with each other. And that's a very important thing if society is to run. So we need human beings. That's my first point. My second point is about the show, which is the question, why do human beings want to cooperate? Why do human beings want to offer things to other people to be generous? Now, the peacock is the male version of the peafowl. It wants the attention of the other sex. Now, Charles Darwin, the great naturalist, didn't like this. He had a problem with the peacocks In fact, he said in a letter to a friend that the sight of a feather in a peacock's tail makes me sick whenever I gaze at it. He wrote this in a letter in April 1860. That was just half a year after he published a very famous book, The Origin of Species, which specified that life is all about survival, survival of the fittest, as someone later called it, that life is about efficiency, being economic with your resources, surviving, engineeringly correct solutions, never waste anything, survive. And Darwin was looking out the window in April 1860, and he was seeing the peacocks running around, the flowers flowering, the birds singing, women being beautiful, and all this stuff that isn't really necessary. Why is there all this wonder in nature? And the problem is that attention, like the peacock is good at getting, it might give you sex, but attention is also very dangerous because there are tigers out there in India where peacocks come from. And tigers can spot this idiotic, silly, huge tail of the peacock and eat the peacock. And you have to run around with this huge tail all the time, so you'll have difficulty getting ahead in life. So attention is dangerous. Why do you want attention? That was explained not long ago by an Israeli bird scientist called Amos Sahavi, who came up with the handicap principle. And what the handicap principle tells you is that the peacock wants the tail exactly because it has no function, because it is anti-functional, because it is weird and absurd and silly to run around with. That's why the peacock wants the tail. The peahen wants some honesty in advertising. And what she's basically saying is, if you can handicap yourself with an idiotic tail and still survive, you've got to have good genes. Anyone with bad genes couldn't survive with that kind of absurdity. So what you want is honesty in advertising, and wasting your resources will tell you that they are vast indeed. Whenever you really have a lot to offer or a lot of risks that you want to take, you prove that you are very strong. Being functional, being rational, doing the meaningful stuff, that's also for the people without any resources. But wasting resources, that shows that you have a lot of them. What if you're a human being? How do human beings advertise their honesty? What works is altruism, doing something for others, because doing something for others is exactly putting upon yourself a handicap, a burden, so to speak. You're not just going for your own interest. And altruism is spectacular. It attracts attention. When you take risks, when you are generous towards other people, when you give comfort and care to other people, you show that you have enough resources that you can share them. And whenever somebody says to you, oh, but you didn't have to, that's a sign that you are in fact displaying your vast resources. So what you want to do is you want to dare, you want to care, and you want to share. You want to do things that other people can see are risky, showing that you have confidence in yourself. You want to take care of other people because that's the best way to show that you're the right one to get laid with or to stay married with. This doesn't have to be sleeping around. It could be just keeping your relationship going. And you want to share because you have so much that you can share with other people. So the business model of this is that if you dare, care, and share, you get attention. And if you have attention, you get sex, jobs, and recognition. And that's what you want, not necessarily in that order. So sex is the origin of all that is noble. This is really where all the good stuff comes from. So let them not take sex away by biotechnology, by rational reproduction. Do not take the lewdness out of us, because that's what's driving everything. Without everybody going out for sex, there will be no open source. We need this. I'm glad that you understand. So who are we? Are we fallen angels, like the old traditions say, or are we flesh rising towards the heaven? And my argument is we are horny flesh rising towards the high thing. So now I come to the flow part, which is about noticing the very simple fact that we are very, very different from material objects. Now this chair or this building will stay the same because the atoms in this chair or in this building will stay the same atoms. There's no change of atoms or the building will collapse. But if you think about yourself, and you add up the amount of food and water and air you take in every year, it adds up to 1.5 ton. That's a lot of stuff. It goes out again at the other end, as you know, and you sort of basically keep your body weight, but there's a huge flow of matter through you, and you can measure that 90%, 98% of the atoms in your body are replaced every year. So you're more like a river with the water flowing through, or flame with the air going through and being heated, than you're like a chair or a building. You're very, very different. You are in a constant flow. You are in what I would call a permanent reincarnation, playing on the permanent revolution of Trotsky. You are sort of, you're not an incarnation in the sense that there's a soul floating around looking for some body to inhabit, but you are an incarnation more like you're a piece of software constantly changing the hardware on which you are running. Because the atoms are changed all the time, and as the physicist Richard Feynman said all the way back in the 50s, the potatoes I had yesterday now remember my childhood, which is pretty odd. So you're like the digital media where you can change your pop songs from the LP to the CD to the iPod to some web application out there. You always need to have some physical representation of stuff, but then it can change all the time. So you are more like a flow, and you need to take in all this food. The food we eat these days is pretty alien to us. The kind of food we're used to eating is more like meat and vegetables and fruit, but we constantly eat grains and potatoes all the time these days, which is something we've only been eating for like 10,000 years. So we have a problem self-regulating now that we have become what is called Stone Agers in the fast lane. This was actually the title of an article in American Medical Journal, where a bunch of anthropologists launched this idea that we are adapted to one environment, the Stone Age environment, but we have created another environment in which we are living, and that makes trouble for us. And since they published this in 1988, we've seen the wave of obesity and other diseases related to the fact that we eat something we are not used to eating and that our body has a problem regulating. So we are in a misfit situation when it comes to nutrition. We are moving towards a situation where we will be eating food from the pre-agricultural situation, where we are going back to generosity and gift economy, which is very common in pre-industrial societies and is becoming now again in our society, and that our social life is coming out of our biology rather than our rational discussions. Also, we know from the very recent debates over the climate and the heating of this planet that we have to get online into the flow of sunshine on this planet. We've been offline for like a few hundred years, taking stuff out of the ground as oil or nuclear power, but we have to get into that cycle, recycling of energy and of information coming from the sun, so we have to get sunline again, online with the sunshine. I would argue that we are approaching, again, a hunter-gatherer society. We are becoming pre-industrial again, that we are creating a new old economy, which is more like a gift economy. We are creating in new ways and a very old kind of food that's very varied and is more based on wild plants and animals. We are replacing our new kind of fossil energy with the old kind of energy, sunshine, and we are replacing our social order with a much more bottom-up-like social order like they have in so-called primitive societies, and we are starting to become more nomadic again. So we are moving in another direction. And what is it that is happening in the long term? I think what's happening in the long term is that we are now inventing civilization 2.0. We are going back to a lot of wisdom that we used to have and that we have to reinvent. And this wisdom is like 10,000 years ago, civilization 1.0 started. That was agriculture giving us cities, giving us domestication of animals and plants, giving us states, giving us all this stuff that we call civilization 10,000 years ago. And now we have to move on. We have to move on to getting back into the cycle of everything and do that. Of course, we should facilitate the creation of a civilization 2.0, with the help of Web 2.0 applications that will bring people together and help them create movements that will bring us back into being online with the sunshine.
Thanks to Tor Norchanders and Craig Warren Smith. If you have ideas to share with us, send email to future@O'Reilly.com. I'm Daniel Steinberg. Distributing the Future is a production of O'Reilly Media. Special thanks to David Bettino for composing and performing this theme. Visit David at Batmosphere.com. This program was produced on Mac OS X Tiger using Soundtrack Pro, Bias Peak, and Audio Hijack Pro. It was run through Gigavox's Levelator at least once.